express my thanks to members, permanent, semi-permanent, non-permanent of this institute for making this such a great place and showing me and my family such great hospitality over the many times we've been here. So this is a great place, and let's keep it that way. Okay, let me get down to the business of quantum gravity. Today's seminar, and I'll focus on causal dynamical triangulations, which is one approach. Now, I was already asked, this is the Radboud University, that's the place where I've been since September 1st. I'm a member of the Institute of Mathematics, Astrophysics, and Particle Physics, EMAP, and currently spending a few weeks here at the Institute. Now, these pictures already should give you a flavor of what to expect. Space-times made up of triangular structures, this is really something much too classical for our purposes, so this is much more representative of the objects we'll meet when we try and do quantum gravity in the Planckian regime. Now, let me start by just listing a few challenges we might want to address in quantum gravity, and more specifically in a non-perturbative context where we are interested in genuine Planckian dynamics where curvature or whatever is there on these distances is very highly quantum fluctuating. So the big questions we can ask and we may hope to ultimately answer, at least partially, are as follows. So what are the quantum laws underlying general relativity? So what is a more fundamental gravitational theory, a quantum theory, this is what I'm presuming, can we do things like explain gravitational interactions captured by Newton's law, or more generally, of course, by general relativity, from first quantum principles? What are the quantum origins of space and time? Does this question make sense? What is the quantum microstructure of space-time? What are the relevant degrees of freedom whose dynamics I might study at Planckian distances? And of course, in a more technical vein, which observables capture properties of this putative quantum space-time quantum geometry at very short distances? Now, it's handy. There are, of course, a variety of approaches being studied, many of them under this roof, too, to have some means of ways of distinguishing them. And of course, they will all make some choice of what the elementary degrees of freedom are going to be. So that tends to be, they tend to be geometric or perhaps some extension of geometric. And of course, by the choice of a particular dynamical principle, so your equations have to come from somewhere. But what I want to focus here a little bit more is the question of the background structure. So by background structure, I mean those things you put into the theory, I mean before you even start calculating, and you assume them as fixed, so it's a choice you make. And of course, people make a lot of fuss about doing working in background independent formulations, but of course this really should be understood as relative, because you will always put in some kind of background, so you have to start from somewhere. So there is here this classic hierarchy of things you might consider either being part of the background, and therefore kind of not touching them, or being part of the dynamics. So the metric structure is kind of on top of this hierarchy. Will you choose a specific background metric, like one does, of course, when one does perturbation theory? Here it becomes, of course, of lower hierarchy, will the differentiable structure become dynamical in your approach, maybe the manifold structure as such, its topology, and maybe even things like its dimension. So one could have, if you really want to think of it as a one-dimensional linear scale, let me draw it like this. You know, here you have less background, and here you have more background. Well, let me just place a few points of reference just in terms of the talks we've heard recently in this room and elsewhere. So something like what John Donoghue was talking to us about some 10 days ago, that was kind of effective gravity. I'd, I place here. You can certainly think of having even more background. For instance, special symmetries associate with specific background structures like background metric. But of course, there is a whole space of, there is a lot of freedom to relax this much more. And what we were hearing yesterday in the colloquium, I would place somewhere out here. So this is kind of the real, the bare bones. You know, you cannot possibly get away with assuming less structure than what Faye did yesterday. Albi.
Isn't she really off the screen?
No, she's not off the screen because I only have decided, you know, not to let this axis run further. I don't know whether there's any lower bound, truly. Now, of course, you know, there are pluses and minuses. Yeah. So, of course, if you are too far out here, you clearly run a risk of maybe fixing too much of your structure. So maybe leaving not enough degrees of freedom, not enough space for your dynamics, your non-perturbative dynamics to take place. On the other hand, going this way, of course, in general, you will have to work very hard to recover, you know, these nice structures in some appropriate semi-classical limit from your quantum theory. So you see, I'll go for some kind of compromise. Now, where are we in our search of quantum gravity? I'm, of course, cutting a long story very short. Of course, many people of you are very familiar with this as a subject. I would say there has been, of course, a historical divide, which to some extent is still very important for the subject and how people think about it. So this is kind of best captured by here these two characters. Feynman, on the one hand, standing for the gravity is just like any other field theory point of view. So by this, we think of, you know, doing fixed background, studying graviton scattering and such things, just treating the thing like a normal perturbative quantum field theory with all, you know, the difficulties this entails. And on the other hand, the point of view, gravity is special. So geometry is really distinct from other degrees of freedom, other fields we might want to think of. So there has been this split, which has determined also how people have done their research and also has been related to some extent to the issue of background structure. So we associate more the kind of fixed background metric, of course, with a perturbative kind of particle physics picture. And here the idea of, well, doing just something completely different for your geometric degrees of freedom, quantizing them non-perturbatively and what have you. Of course, such division is rarely a good idea. Now, what I would claim and would say research I've been involved in is a good example of is that over the last 10 years or so, a lot of progress in quantum gravity has really come by combining elements from, you know, across the divide, you could say. So in particular, I want to mention kind of being minimalist, so not heaping too much extra background structure, extra symmetries, extra new ingredients, on top of the ones that are already present in the classical theory, and making as few as possible kind of prior assumptions, but getting, so in a way, staying in a rather conservative framework, using only standard quantum field theoretic methods, but abandoning really the background, the fixed background metric of the perturbative theory, and making the whole thing non-perturbative in a way. So that, of course, it captures also a lot of the spirit of what is behind kind of what we've come to know as non-perturbative quantization approaches to gravity. So that already brings me to the main topic of today's talk, as announced in my abstract. So I'll be focusing on this approach that has now been around for, well, if you count kind of the higher dimensional results, 8-9 years ago, but of course the idea has been there for almost 15 years, based on stuff that came before in a very similar vein. So this is the quantum gravity from causal dynamical triangulations, or CDT for short. It's essentially a non-perturbative implementation of the gravitational path integral. very much in the spirit of lattice quantum field theory. So a regularization, a kind of lattice regularization, plays an important part at an intermediate stage of formulating the theory, putting it into a form where I can calculate with it, and then taking non-trivial limits in order to hopefully recover some interesting continuum structures. Now, the lattices will not be fixed lattices, as they would be, say, in lattice gauge field theory, where you just usually start from, a hypercubic lattice, and you never touch it. So here, reflecting the dynamical nature of space-time, we work with dynamical lattices. So the structure of the lattice will be subject to dynamics. So, and that will exactly kind of reflect kind of the properties of classical general relativity, you could say. CDT, to my knowledge, is currently the only candidate theory of quantum gravity which can claim to generate a ground state of geometry, which you might call a quantum space, some kind of a solution of the quantum theory, which has recognizable, definite, semi-classical features, and without putting in any background metric at any stage. So it's really just a quantum superposition. And here, of course, that's our pink universe. And I'll get back to this point in a little while. Apart from that, causal dynamical triangulation and also its precursor in Euclidean signature called dynamical triangulations, DT for short, has given us crucial new insights into properties of non-perturbative quantum gravitational models, and in particular has exhibited a number of kind of pitfalls, which I believe are rather generic and occur when you let geometry loose on very short scales. Here, the star refers to the fact that the results that I'm presenting in the talk today are mostly based on collaborations with a number of longstanding collaborators. Jan Arbjorn is here in the audience. Jerzy Jukiewicz is in Krakow. Andrzej Görlich is currently at the Niels Bohr Institute in Copenhagen. And Samuel Jordan is my PhD student in Nijmegen, who is just finishing, and much more about, in particular, also his work, to follow in the rest of today's talk. Now, this is a very important summary slide of the types of ingredients that go into what I do. So, as I said before, it's very handy if you compare different approaches just to say, okay, now what are your priors? What are the ingredients? What are the assumptions you're making before you even get started with doing computations? So here I'd claim we have rather few of these ingredients and priors. So what I'm using is definitely the quantum superposition principle. I'll be looking at the gravitational Feynman type path integral. I use a local, at least at the bare level, I use a local action. And the path integral configurations I integrate over also carry already a knowledge of the causal structure of space-time. And of course, yesterday in the colloquium, we heard a Daukos talk on an approach that puts this very, very central. So what I'm saying here, causal structure is also put in here at a very basic level. And I wouldn't do that. Many or all of the results I'm going to talk about would just not be there. So I mentioned it already here. In order to implement a causal structure or the presence of a specific causal structure on individual path integral histories, it's very handy to have a notion of proper time. And that is what has always been used in these models in 2, 3, and 4 dimensions. And you see here a little piece of a causal triangulation of that type. So you have a sliced structure. So within your space-time histories, you have a natural notion of time, if you like, is kind of, because they have all a kind of a layered structure. And what makes part of the causal structure is that as a function of this kind of discrete time label, the topology of the spatial slices does not change. And that already ensures you a certain degree a well-behaved causal structure on the individual path integral histories. Now, the proper time or the specific type of building blocks I'm using, rather, will also enable me to wick rotate a complex superposition of amplitudes to an object that is real and I can therefore in higher dimensions calculate with, because I cannot do analytic calculations in four dimensions. So I have to rely on numerical ways of trying to understand the dynamics that's given by this formulation. So that's also an important ingredient. Otherwise, I just use kind of standard tools from quantum field theory. I'm not making any other assumptions, extra ingredients. I have only, yes. No. Well, you'll see later what the wick rotation means, but essentially it just means I have a way to uniquely map these Lorentzian, you know, triangulated piecewise flat spaces onto Euclidean piecewise flat objects in such a way that my e to the is gets mapped exactly onto a e to the minus s Euclidean with a certain prescription of evaluating kind of the Einstein action on these objects. So you should regard it as a technical step. You know, there is a complex, you know, I have to evaluate sums over complex amplitudes in a certain limit where this clearly is a very divergent object. And I just do the rotation in Euclidean after wick rotating with the idea, of course, of extracting, I mean, doing the inverse wick rotation at the end of whatever I calculate, or at least extract the genuine physical Lorentzian physics from the Euclidean computation I'm making ultimately. Okay, but I want also to point out it's distinct from starting in Euclidean straight away, because the wick rotated Lorentzian objects still carry a memory of the causal structure that was there in the fully Lorentzian way of looking at it. Okay, yes.
Does this wick rotated version allow you to study also finite temperature statistical mechanics of classical graphs?
I would say I wouldn't venture so far as saying that, because I'm, as you'll see in what follows, I'm very, very far away from anything that looks classical. So and where it would be easy for me to start addressing interesting questions one would ask, maybe coming from the classical theory. Now, was there a question? Okay. Now, as a consequence, you say, could say partially of having a rather simple-minded setup with not too many additional ingredients, I have only a few free parameters at this stage. They are the cosmological constants. So I will have a bare action that has both the standard kind of scalar curvature term evaluated on these piecewise flat objects. It will have a cosmological constant term where lambda is positive, the bare cosmological constant. It needs to be for the construction to work. And then I have something that comes naturally with the kind of anisotropic choice I've made for my geometry. So I told you I have kind of a distinguished foliation in the background. And that, of course, if I just look at these geometries, they look different in the time direction from what they look in a generic space direction. And since I'm doing that at the level of a regularized theory, I have some freedom, kind of a relative finite scaling between what I do with the time direction and what I do with the spatial directions. And this parameter delta is a reflection of that, and we'll see later on it will appear as a parameter of the phase space of the system. So I wick rotate that, I then study it as a kind of statistical mechanical system of a certain ensemble of geometric objects, and I will then look and be interested in how this behaves as I vary the bare coupling constants of this model. By construction, kind of this is robust. And of course, I've told you what I'll do. It's not to postulate that, say, the edge lengths of my fundamental building blocks are to be identified, say, with a Planck length, kind of by fiat. But what I'll want to do is to just regard this as a regularization with a UV cutoff, which is essentially the length of the building blocks, the size of the building blocks, which I want to send to zero in any continuum limit I'm taking. And doing it this way will ensure me of a certain degree of universality. So what I'm really after is uncovering a regime of the theory where I can take a large volume limit, an infinite volume limit, coupled possibly with a fine-tuning, appropriate fine-tuning of my bare coupling constants to reach kind of what one calls a scaling limit, which is then such that many of the arbitrary regularization details I've used in order to make this theory calculable will just drop out, will just disappear from the formalism, and only hopefully certain universal properties characteristic of the underlying continuum theory will remain. So that's the idea. Of course, you will have to check in detail of whether the model you're writing down in this way does genuinely have these properties you wish it to have. So what we are using at an intermediate stage, as I already said, I don't use curved spacetimes because I don't really know how to do an integral over all possible curved spacetimes if they're just, say, smooth objects or some standard continuum curved manifolds. But I approximate these by these much simpler objects, which are the piecewise flat things and just triangulations, as we'll see. What is crucial for me to have are that I have non-perturbative computational tools available, which will enable me to say something about the path integral. So that's extremely important, and to extract some numbers. So what I call results are numbers. I will now go on to really very briefly describe the technical setup, which makes use of these ingredients, and then look at some of the results as this has already produced. So there are some what I would call classic results. I'll go rather briefly over these. So the emergence of space-time, I have already mentioned this funny thing of the scale-dependent dimensionality near the Planck scale. The fact that we have a non-trivial phase structure and what it is and how much we already know about it. And then I will also mention several new results of the last few months, as a matter of fact. Okay, so here goes. This is our starting point, the Feynman path integral for gravity. This is now the very formal continuum object that everyone writes down. I call this object Z, anticipating that it will soon become a kind of a partition function after I quick rotate it. It depends at this stage on two free parameters, Newton's constant, Gn, and a cosmological constant. And this is just the Einstein-Hilbert action, which I've written out again for you here, with a curvature term depending on first and second derivatives of the metric and a cosmological constant term. And what I'm supposed to do here is to superpose all space times, all curved space times. Now, this is, of course, a priori a very ill-defined thing. You can write it down. But in order to make it operationally well-defined, you have to say what this space of all space times is. And I've already indicated how I'm going to approximate it. So this is really a very standard picture of a superposition of these amplitudes of kind of all possible paths where you should give me some boundary conditions. And often one thinks here of fixing geometric spatial data at some initial slice and having some other spatial data at some final slice and then looking at all space-time geometries that can be stuck put in between those. Of course, they are in general, they have nothing to do with classical solutions of the theory. They are like, in the path integral for the non-relativistic particle, they are just all possible paths. And the same will be true here. Each one of these paths, so they trace out kind of space times, if you like. So I'm thinking of them as three-dimensional spatial geometries developing in time, although Faye Dauker yesterday told me that I should never do such a thing. Now, and I weigh each of them then with, the Einstein-Hilbert action. And then I look at what this superposition is. Since I want to do this non-perturbatively, I know that the perturbative sum is, of course, has all nasty, kind of nasty non-real normalizable properties. I have now to specify how I'm going to make sense of this right-hand side.
Excuse me, so the partition function
It always depends, of course, the path integral, although you often don't write them, it always will depend on the boundary conditions you're choosing. Yeah. Yes.
So in this CDT type theories, if you look at low energy effective field theory approximation,
yeah.
Would you expect something like string theory where you have the Einstein-Hilbert action plus higher order high derivative corrections?
Oh, okay, yeah, a very good point. So you could say, I mean, often the comment is made, hang on, you are restricting yourself just to two terms in the Einstein action, whereas I know that, of course, there should be a whole bunch of higher curvature terms that is compatible with the symmetries. And the answer is, yes, I will generate all of those. So they come really from the sum over spacetime. So if you like, you could say that in the measure. So the only thing, the only assumption I'm making currently here, how are contributions that come from the measure, how are they distinguished from those in the bare action? Well, in the bare action, I have coupling constants, which I can tune explicitly. So in a way, the assumption I'm making here is it's sufficient to tune, you know, the few parameters that appear in the bare action for me to see an interesting continuum theory. This is an assumption that might turn out to be wrong. Maybe I will see nothing interesting here. I might then consider adding in the bare action already, say, certain higher curvature terms with tunable parameters in principle, look at a larger phase space, and then see what happens there. So that's the logic. Yeah, thanks for the question. Okay, so how do we make sense of the path integral? Well, we triangulate, and a beautiful feature of representing smooth curved manifolds by piecewise flat objects is that you need much fewer data in order to describe a geometry of a given size, just a finite list of data, but with the discretization, the regularization I'm choosing, but also that you never have to introduce coordinates. So you never have to introduce, the x0 to x3 and then write your geometric physical degrees of freedom as a function of these coordinates. And thereby, of course, introducing, as we know, a huge gauge redundancy, namely diffeomorphism symmetry in the system. So I never introduce coordinates of this type. So my path integral will not have that redundancy in it by construction. So what I'm going to do, I will represent kind of the formal continuum integral over all curved spacetime geometries by a sum over these piecewise straight structures. So here, let me just illustrate, first of all, here on the left-hand side, how you can think by making the triangulation finer and finer, approximating curved spaces better and better. So this is just to illustrate the basic principle. So this is what you would do classically if you're interested in, say, describing a two-dimensional curved surface embedded in three-dimensional space. You just make the triangulations finer and finer. And the finer the triangulation, the more accurately you will capture its curvature properties. What we're going to do in the quantum theory is something slightly different. Our aim is not to approximate a given space-time, as well as possible, even in a local sense. But what we want to approximate is the space of all curved objects. So that's a quite different ballgame. And what we'll see is that generic objects in this ensemble will look very non-classical. So don't be surprised, even if they look something like this here. So this is a two-dimensional configuration from Euclidean dynamical triangulations, a path integral, made from little equilateral triangles. And this is a way in which it's a graphic representation in which these triangles like to arrange themselves typically. So this is some kind of quite wild object and locally rather a curved object, which is very far from apparently from any classical smooth space time. So however, this will be generic and it will also be in higher dimensions generic. these objects, the typical, if you like, path integral histories will just look individually highly non-classical. And of course, I'll have them to integrate over the space. And I can, as I said before, in higher dimensions, only currently do this numerically. So I can kind of sample the path integral after big rotation. In lower dimension, you can do much more. In two dimensions, you can actually analytically solve a whole bunch of these models, and they have beautiful properties, and you can identify Hamiltonians, Hilbert spaces, etc. So you have very explicit control over these things. Already in dimension three, it gets much, much, much harder. And in dimension four, well, it's basically impossible to say anything analytical about these path integrals, not even in some kind of asymptotic sense. So there, you first have to look at Monte Carlo simulation and use those to maybe do effective model building, and then go back to the simulation. So that's kind of the type of creative interaction you will then look for. Okay. Yes.
But you're triangulating a manifold which is embedded as a codimension one submanifold.
No, it's not embedded at all in the sense that, you know, what I have to give you in order to give one of these triangulations, first of all, I should say, it comes on the next page. I use essentially equilateral building blocks. So the building blocks are individual, they look all the same. Mm-hmm. So what I give, the data I have to give you in order to tell you, say, what the four-dimensional space-time is, I just give you a long list of these objects and tell you how they are glued together pairwise. So this doesn't refer at all to any embedding. So say I give each of these blocks a little label, and then I tell you, the site 7 of object 5 is glued to site 3 of object 28. So I give you just a long list of data which never refer to any embedding. So it's a totally intrinsic way of describing geometry. Each individual building block, by definition, is a piece of flat Minkowski space. So if you think, say, of two dimensions, all that suffices, all that you need to know is what the edge lengths are of a triangle, and say, to know that it's a piece of two-dimensional flat Minkowski space in order to know all about its geometric properties. The next step is then you start gluing them together, and then the glued object can, of course, acquire curvature properties in places where you glue things together. Well, I will have two types of edge lengths I allow. One is a space-like edge length, and one is a time-like edge length. So I'm working with two different edge lengths, but that's all. So not many. I mean, it's not like ratchet calculus, where you start with some triangulated lattice, and then you let all the edge lengths vary continuously. So this is not allowed here. So you have only a couple of different edge lengths which you allow. And all your building blocks are made from these elementary edge lengths, if you like. And so what I said, it's intrinsic geometry. I tell you what an individual building block is. I'm just cutting out a little piece out of a Minkowski space. So in particular, with each of these building blocks, I can tell you exactly where light rays go. So I can trace them. It's not that it's just a piece of flat space-time, so structureless from the point of view of Einstein's theory. Then I start gluing them together, and I can pick up curvature. Curvature comes through gluing them in such a way that I get non-trivial deficit angles. When I make kind of walks, I look at parallel transport around closed loops. So and the curvature happens is located in a singular manner at the simplices of dimension d minus 2. So if you are in two dimensions, looking at gluings of two-dimensional triangles, then curvature can only appear at vertices. So the zero-dimensional objects. When I'm in four-dimension, the curvature will appear to be located in a kind of delta function-like manner on two-dimensional triangles. And you can just, however, recover it. You can understand what it is by just performing parallel transports in these triangulations. Yes?
This microscopic curvature comes from counting how many simplices you have around one of these hinges.
Yeah.
It can be either positive or negative.
Yes.
But you can at most take just one simplex and identify faces. So when it's positive, there's a maximum. So my question is, does it introduce a bias? You can have curvature that is positive up to a maximum, but can be negative as much as you want.
As much as we can see, no. So the important thing seems to be that you have indeed possible curvatures of both types. Mm-hmm. And the manifold, I mean, the triangulations, they will always find, say, if they wanted to maximize negative curvature, you will see it in the continuum limit. Although, it's right, if I look at a finite piece of triangulations, you know, there will be bounds on the curvature, negative and positive. But then as you make your triangulation bigger, you will see, you know, if your triangulations want to really maximize, say, negative curvature, you will see it. So indeed, you could say, well, maybe there is something like a bias in the regularization. However, that just only implies that you have to go to a certain size, you know, of the triangulation in order that the system forgets it. Yeah. But you will always then see, of course, we only ever study properties in a large volume limit. So that doesn't make a difference. In 2D, I should say, you can, of course, ask and answer the question like the one you are asking very explicitly. And you can play around with all kind of building blocks and, you know, even you can symmetrize this completely. So you can introduce just, you allow either flat vertices, one where one triangle is missing and one where there is an extra triangle. And you can say, allow only these, and you recover exactly the same continuum theory. So here, these are the four-dimensional building blocks. So I have already done quite some explaining. So they're sitting in some sliced structure where these are the, you know, I label them by something I suggestively call T. Currently, it's just a parameter that appears in the description of my geometries. Now, the four-dimensional building blocks share certain substructures with these integer T kind of preferred foliations. And here, this is a building block that shares an entire tetrahedron with T, time T, and a single vertex with time T plus 1. Here, this is a four-dimensional simplex that does it slightly differently. It shares only a 2D triangle with the lower slice and a one-dimensional link with the upper slice. So we call this 4-1 and 3-2. And then there are, of course, kind of time-reflected versions of these. And these are all the building blocks. So I'm only using these currently to construct my generic piecewise flat manifolds in four dimensions. Here, this is now the explicit way of how I make sense of the path integral, if you like. So my integral has become a sum over inequivalent triangulations, which I made from these building blocks, where, if I want, I can keep track of n the size, so how many building blocks I use, and then I do sum over n. So in principle, I want, of course, to be in a situation where the largest configurations will contribute maximally, because, I'm interested in this n equal to infinity limit. What appears here on the right-hand side is essentially what I call a democratic sum, in the sense that each geometry gets weighed just with e to the is, and this is a kind of a measure factor which is almost trivial, in the sense that c of t is the order of the automorphism group of the triangulation t. And it's only not equal to zero if t, the triangulation, happens to have some discrete symmetries. So this is almost always one. So this is really, you know, this doesn't, it's very democratic. So it just, you know, each distinct geometric gluing is counted exactly once, and the only weighted test is the e to the is, the corresponding. So what I then do, I'm interested in the limit as A, the lattice space in my UV cutoff goes to zero, and N goes to infinity. So that's part of the construction. I wick-rotate this, as I said before, and I don't have now time to go into the nature of the wick-rotation. Essentially, it means I replace all time-like links by space-like ones. And that will uniquely map me from a Lorentzian triangulation to a Euclidean one. Now, as I said already before, the way kind of arranging things to have a well-defined causal structure for each individual path integral history seems to make a difference. So that is, if you like, it's an experimental, it's a result. You can do it with or without. And if you do it without, you don't really get anything interesting in higher dimensions. You don't get extended geometry. Yes?
This limit you take for A and N?
Yeah.
don't they need more, I mean, specification, because you can take these two limits in different ways, right?
Yeah, yeah, yes. So I usually, I mean, a naive way to answer your question, which is not too wrong, would be to say, for instance, I can keep a physical volume fixed. So say something like n, capital N times a to the fourth. Yeah. But of course, in principle, I could, you know, I could arrange various ways of how these two things scale relatively. I want to do it in the first place, try in a canonical way. So a is, of course, one should think of a kind of a length, and n is a discrete volume. So a to the fourth times n is kind of a physical volume, at least, canonically speaking. Yes, but one might think of doing all kinds of interesting scalings, and also, of course, also incorporate possible scalings for the bare couplings. Yeah? Yes.
So could you just explain a little bit more how you randomly generate these? I mean, so you're going to basically find randomly generate symplices that cover four dimensions. And I don't know if that's, is there a procedure to do that?
Yes.
It's a little bit more complicated than generating random numbers, I imagine.
Yes, yeah. So you do this in a kind of Monte Carlo simulations, where you, first of all, you have to establish a number. So you have an ensemble of geometries you want to describe. Then you have a number of local moves, which means that locally change the geometry and thereby kind of move you around in this ensemble. Then you have to show that your moves are such, for example, that you can get anywhere in a finite number of steps. So it's a whole, of course, it's a long story cut very short, but yes, it's non-trivial. But what you then do in the Euclidean path integral, you set up the Monte Carlo such that it samples kind of your Boltzmann distribution, yeah, just accurately. And of course, there are ways and means of doing, you know, of running the Monte Carlo and adjusting its properties that it does that. And this is, of course, highly non-trivial. And there are great people in our collaboration who are very able to do these things. But of course, there's a theory behind it. And there's also, of course, implementation. And in the implementation.
So just one more question.
Yes.
So you said the size of the symplices are fixed.
Yeah. So what you do in reality when you do real simulations, the quantity you are adjusting is capital N. But of course,
the
number of simplices, and you make that larger and larger. So you do, in reality, what you do, you look at the system for some finite N, you know, that could be a few hundred thousand building blocks, and then you try, then you make N larger and larger, and you repeat the same type of measurement, and you look for a systematic scaling as a function of that N, of certain interesting observables, you know, you can study in this. And this is also, this is called finite size scaling. And this is how you determine, yeah, how certain physical observables behave physically in the continuum limit, if there is such a thing. So if such a scaling is indeed present, you know, it might just, you may not be able to find something, but we do, as you see. Okay, now, this was the, you know, this was the background. Now the results. Let me see how much I can get across in a concise form. Now, the first thing, the classic result, is the emergence of a semi-classical geometry as we know it. Now, the statement is here that in a suitable region, largish region of the phase space of the bare coupling constant, I find a ground state of geometry of this path integral I'm simulating in four dimensions, a stable object. And studying its scaling properties, as I just kind of briefly, you know, was sketching in answer to your question, Nyayesh, one finds it's four-dimensional on large scales. And not only is it four-dimensional, it has a specific shape macroscopically, which I can also compare very explicitly, as we'll see, to that of a classical geometry, a classical spacetime. It turns out to be a cosmology. Now in Euclidean signature, namely that of the De Sitter space. So the De Sitter space is, if you like, is a round four sphere. Now, what's the evidence for that, for the De Sitter space in particular? Well, when I zoom in on just one geometric variable, I monitor just one in my big ensemble of geometries. So these geometries have, of course, are described by very, very many, many parameters, but I'm just concentrating on one of them, which is the three volume as a function of this time label t. I find it has a specific non-trivial dependence on t. And it's such, so it has a kind of bump, as we'll see, and it is such that if I, when I calculate the expectation value in the entire ensemble of this shape, I do actually rederive a specific curve for this expectation value of v3 of t. And this I can match beautifully to a classical de Sitter space. Now, the way this comes about is quite non-trivial and is non-perturbative in the sense that we see rather explicitly that in order to bring it about, both energy and entropy play a role. Energy, by this I mean kind of the bare action, and the contribution that comes from the measure, that is, how often a specific value of the weight, the bare weight, appears, you know, in your big, big sum over configurations. So these two things, in the region where you're studying this, they contribute, you know, not the same, but of the same order of magnitude. And the way to see this, for example, is that we can explicitly extract an effective action of the type you were asking about just for this one single variable, the 3-volume, quite directly actually from the simulations, which is quite beautiful. We can compare it to a mini superspace action for the standard scale factor, because V3 is basically just the scale factor cubed of a standard Erich Friedman cosmology. And we can map these two things onto each other. Here's a typical snapshot of such a geometry. So that is a single Monte Carlo configuration in the ensemble. And the only thing I'm plotting is the only relevant variable is really the V3 of t. Time runs this way. And you shouldn't look at these individual triangles. They don't reflect the actual geometry. They only tell you kind of what the volume is in a given slice. So in order to make this into a genuine kind of observable, we are taking the expectation value in the entire ensemble of that. And this then we compare to a continuum curve. And here's a comparison. So here we are looking at a Euclidean de Sitter space in the continuum in a proper time, in proper time variables, t. We have a non-trivial volume element here coming from just the spatial contributions. We are on a spatial S3. And this here characteristically goes like a cosine. I mean, the AFT, the Friedman factor, goes like a cosine of t up to some overall scaling. And therefore, V3, of course, goes like a cosine cubed. So this is the slices of a Euclidean de Sitter space. A Euclidean de Sitter space is a 4-sphere, a round 4-sphere. And it just has this dependence. And you see here two curves, which basically fall completely on top of each other. One is a theoretical curve of the type A cosine cubed T over B. And on top of that is just the expectation value we are extracting from the simulations. These red things are not error bars, but they quantify the typical quantum fluctuations around the mean. So they give you an idea of how quantum this object still is with respect to this volume variable. So you see, it's quite quantum. And it can only be quite quantum because the universes we're actually studying, turns out, they are very, very small. They're like 20, 25 Planck lengths across. So you can see that is why they can have very significant quantum fluctuations around them. A proper time foliation. So I would say, so with hindsight, so the T we are comparing to is a kind of a continuum version of this foliation label I had before. And I told you, well, it looks natural to think of that as some kind of time variable in the discretized picture, but I have a priori no idea what will become of it in the continuum.
It turns out.
Now, what I can say is, in some average sense, because the volume captures only, you know, very integrated properties, in an average sense, it clearly can be mapped onto a global proper time in the continuum. So that's nice. It doesn't tell me anything very much, say, whether locally a similar identification will work. We have no idea. But it gives now, with hindsight, a nice interpretation to this T label in the continuum limit we've been studying. Yes.
Singles out the preferred foliation in the sense that
I'll get to that later, and one could wonder, does it, again, you know, in a similar vein of the question that Eugenio asked, does it introduce some bias, or does it influence, how does it influence my results? So we have something new to say about this. I'll come to this. So other classical results, other more local ways of probing quantum genuine, quantum properties of this quantum space-time I've constructed, and the answer is yes. You look at dimensions, and there, of course, the interesting message that most of you will be aware of is that dimension in this type of non-perturbative quantum gravity game can behave in very, very unexpected ways once you get down to very, very small scales. So in particular, even if you put in, say, four-dimensional building blocks, it can just happen that because of the very non-trivial limit you are taking and of the contributions you get from entropy, depending on where you are in phase space, your ground state will have not dimension four at all, neither macroscopically nor microscopically. So that's maybe one of the general lessons to be learned from here. And very explicitly, of course, we've seen this happen, say, when we looked at a diffusion process and extracted the so-called spectral dimension from it. And, well, the idea is a one that applies very generally to all kinds of spaces, including fractals, but it happens to apply also to these piecewise flat spaces. After you recrotate, well, you have certain natural kind of Laplacians, in a way, discrete Laplacians on these objects, and you can study diffusion processes or related processes. And by the way, how, say, you know, the diffusion process or the random walker equivalently behaves as a function of some external diffusion time, you are able to extract certain properties, invariant properties of that underlying space in which the diffusion is taking place. And there is a very neat way of extracting exactly the spectral dimension. So it's kind of the dimensionality seen by a little random walker. So that starts from some point x0 and then, you know, wiggles around in the manifold to make some kind of Brownian motion time. And of course, we know in general, you know, there's one way of defining a linear distance, say, is to say, well, the linear distance is typically something like the square root of sigma. Now, if we make this identification, then it becomes very natural to extract kind of a characteristic dimension, which is basically looks at how big is the ink cloud kind of the diffusion after a certain diffusion time sigma. Yeah? And then extracting the leading power of sigma of that volume, and dividing by two, you get to the spectral dimension. And it's just, it characterizes in an invariant manner a curved space or a very general kind of geometric space. And what we find here is this funny, interesting sigma dependence, so a distant dependence. If I run such a process on a smooth manifold, as long as I don't probe very large curvature scales, I will just always see dimension four. So this is kind of the classical space-time manifold. However, when I do it on this quantum space and generated by CDT, I see this characteristic scale dependence. Very intriguingly, similar things have been seen in other kind of conservative quantum field theoretic approaches to quantum gravity, like the non-perturbative renormalization group flow analysis, the non-relativistic Lifshitz type quantum gravity. And I should say this has spawned a whole development where people are computing spectral dimensions in their favorite model of quantum gravity and very often being able, let me phrase it like that, to retrieve qualitatively or even quantitatively very similar results. It is a whole kind of area, has become a whole area of research on its own, which I'm not going to describe any further because I'm running out of time. Now, I have already mentioned to you really what's in the background of my construction you should think of as a kind of a statistical mechanical system, because I've rotated to Euclidean signature, my path integral is real, and consequently, I can just treat it with the standard methods, that's what I'm effectively doing, of studying statistical mechanical systems. In particular, as I said before, I look at how the system behaves as a function of the bare couplings. I have three parameters, and you find them all back in my, you know, the Regi version of the Einstein-Hilbert action, And they're very, the actions of a very simple type. And there are three constants that appear. Kappa naught is essentially the inverse Bernoulli-Newton constant. Lambda is the cosmological constant. And this delta is this asymmetry, this finite scaling between space and time-like direction. So I have these three parameters. And I'm interested in characterizing kind of the phase structure as a function of these three parameters. And for a long time, we've known, first of all, that you have to tune lambda to get to a critical surface, a two-dimensional subsurface. And this is tantamount to saying I tune lambda such that n, the discrete volume, can actually go to infinity and contribute non-trivially to my path integral. It's not suppressed. So the only interesting thing that remains is this 2D surface. And this we've also known, but what we haven't known is the precise nature of the phase transitions between the three phases we found. So we have the very nice phase, the physical phase, characterized by this extended geometry. This is phase C for sufficiently large values of this delta parameter and sufficiently small values of the inverse Newton constant. We have a phase A with degenerate fluctuating geometries, and then we have this kind of pancake-like phase B, where also there doesn't seem to be any interesting classical macroscopically four-dimensional limit. So what we've been able to do, or rather my PhD student Salma Jordan has been able to do, is to really work out what the order of these transitions is. And that's a highly relevant thing, because kind of in standard statistical mechanics language, you would, of course, be looking for phase transitions of second or higher order, because by approaching those in specific ways from inside, say, the phase of good geometry, you would presumably reach a continuum theory, a well-defined continuum theory, well, if you're lucky. And it turns out that this BC transition, we have now very good evidence that this is indeed a second order transition. It seems to have an endpoint here, seems to have a triple point, but it's impossible for us to access these numerically at this stage. So the interesting message is, presumably this line is everywhere along there, these are candidates for possible continuum theories. And they might even depend maybe in some systematic way, possibly on where I am or whether I'm sitting at the endpoint, at the triple points. There might be even, of course, higher order transitions at these points. We don't know currently. This here we have also measured appears to be just a first order transition. So these are just results from a year back. And just to give you an impression of the type of analysis one does in order to determine the order of the phase transition, you're sitting, say, next to one of these phase transition lines, and then we pick a geometric observable. And here we're looking at the conjugate, so whatever is multiplied by the constant delta. So this is just some expression where these counting variables appear. And we see that near the phase transition, it will oscillate between two different values. So if you let Monte Carlo time run, you'll see the system jumping from one to the other and back. If you make a histogram, you see exactly kind of two peaks. Now, this is typical for the vicinity of a phase transition, but it doesn't nail down the order of the transition. What you have to do is you systematically study now these peaks as a function of the discrete volume of the simulation system. So you make it bigger and bigger. And what we see here in this case is when we make it bigger, the peaks, the two peaks we see from here, they move closer. Yeah. So, and this is a signal, one possible signal of a second order phase transition. So say, if you were in a first order transition, you would see more a pronounced falling into two generally distinct phases. So then this gap would become deeper or more pronounced. And there's also not necessary, it will not necessarily move together. So that's one piece of evidence it might be second order. There are various other things, and you're fitting to various scaling coefficient. I now don't have time to explain, but just to give you the general picture, that it's a quite non-trivial, and certainly for lattices of the size, you're looking at quite subtle analysis that has to take place. But from this type of analysis, we have concluded with that we have good evidence that there is such a second order phase transition. And that opens, of course, all kinds of doors to us, say, to compare to the asymptotic safety scenario, which predicts the existence of a non-trivial fixed point in the UV. So at least on the phase of things, that seems up to this point quite compatible with what we're seeing in this quite different framework. Very briefly, because I promised it in my abstract, a new and old thing. So a little while ago, of course, we're doing things the causal way, and we are claiming, you know, you have to do it the causal way because otherwise you don't see anything interesting. Now, a couple of people came along, Jack Lyell and his student Daniel Kuhn, and they redid old Euclidean simulations for, so no causal structure, no time, nothing. Now, what is the story? Well, the story is, of course, that in standard Euclidean dynamical triangulations, as I mentioned briefly to you, one doesn't see any interesting semi-classical geometry. And when one has studied the phase structure, as I did now on the previous, I showed you on the previous slide for the CDT, the analogous, one has only a one-dimensional phase diagram, one fine-tunes the cosmological constant, and then one has just phases as a function of Newton's constant. And the only thing one has ever found are a crumpled phase and a branched follinear phase with a first-order phase transition in between them. So you certainly cannot claim there is any evidence there should be an interesting continuum theory behind this. Now, people already a long time ago thought about now introducing additional tunable parameters. And one way you can do it is by putting a different measure term into the path integral and see what it is. This was what I was using. And here, so this works for any signature, in particular also for the Euclidean signature. And now here, people added a weight that depends on the order of a triangle. The order of a triangle has to do with how many four simplices share this triangle. It's like a higher dimensional analog of how many triangles sit around a vertex in one plus in two dimensions. So it's a higher dimensional analog of that, and it has to do in some way with curvature, with higher order curvature also. So you can do that. You put simply, you go through all the triangles in your triangulation, and each one you check what the order is at the triangle, OI, and then you take it to the power beta. And beta is your new free tunable parameter. So that's way of looking at it was first done like 15 or almost 20 years ago by Brückmann and Marinari in the old Euclidean DT, and then looked at when people were, the phase structure was already analyzed, one had never saw anything interesting as a function of this beta parameter. Now, Laiho and Kuhn came along and said, look, we redid the calculation. You're seeing a very interesting distance dimension, spectral dimension also here. Perhaps the only thing you have to do in order to see something interesting is just to introduce a third coupling. In CDT, our third coupling comes from this, you know, causal anisotropy, if you like, that we are introducing by making things causal, introducing this time slicing. But maybe this is all just mumbo jumbo. You know, you just need a third coupling constant. So they didn't do an analysis of the phase structure of that, but they claimed, so they made such claims. This is an interesting claim, right? So can we understand kind of what is the essence of these models? So that's what we want to understand. What is really, which part of them you cannot do without and which are really important to lead to the results we are seeing. So this is a conjecture based on some measurements. So they found a spectral dimension that in this crinkled phase, you get when you let beta become non-zero and sufficiently negative, you see a new phase with apparently new properties. Now, my collaborators, Jan Ambion and Andrzej Görlich, Lisa Glas and Yuri Jokiewicz, have done a very careful scanning, so they tell me, of this enlarged coupling constant space. So it's stuff that people had done before, but it eats a lot and lot of, you know, computer time. So it's not something you just do in a couple of weeks. And they find absolutely no evidence of the presence of a phase transition of higher order. It's a long story, which I'm cutting short. But it probably means, well, there's some fluke here. So at some finite volumes, you may see lots of interesting looking phenomena, but they then often go away as n becomes large. So that might be a case of that. Now, coming back to the theme of which part of background structure is really important and we cannot do without. Now, the obvious thing to focus on is to say, aha, look, you have these time foliations there. That looks very fishy to me. You're introducing some extra structure, and this clearly breaks some symmetry. I mean, Lorentz invariance is, of course, not present, but one might fear that if eventually one comes to, this becomes a continuum theory, and you can take a, you know, a large, a small curvature limit of some kind, then Lorentz symmetry might be broken. That's a very far distance off, but one could, and it's of course a very valid question to ask, what is the role of time? So why do we need to have it? Well, we needed it to say, well, time is distinguished, and for instance, we do not want topology change as a function of time. But in order to say that, you don't have to distinguish a notion of time. You could just choose any other one. So can we think of a generalization of our model where we dissociate imposing a kind of local causality, I mean, imposing things to be locally well-behaved in these individual path integral histories, can we dissociate that from the notion of a distinguished time foliation being present? And so far, we didn't really have a good idea of how to do that until, again, my student Salma had a great idea of how it might be done. So the key is, so this is the usual, for simplicity in 1+1, the usual setup it leads to the foliation. We have in 1+1 dimension a single building block with one space-like edge, two time-like edges, and we construct our causally dynamically triangulated objects by kind of stacking these strips on top of each other. So you can identify then these purely spatial layers. Yeah? So don't be fooled. This is, of course, a highly curved object, yeah, because the curvature is sitting everywhere in terms of deficit angles here. But this is a general structure. This is a slicing. His idea was now, let's try and use more general building blocks such that causality is maintained everywhere locally, but we get away from any distinguished time slicing. And this is what you have to do in 1+1. You take the old building block, here just seen, you know, with its internal light cone structure, and you add to it a new building block, which is also just a piece kind of cut out of the same Minkowski space. And it has the same edge length, space-like, but it has two space-like edges and one single time-like edge. And the light cone, of course, lies like this here. Now, if you now look at arbitrary gluings of these things, you will immediately see that even locally at a vertex, they violate causality in the sense that you don't have kind of a nice a pair of a future and backward-pointing light cone. However, you can just impose these local causality conditions at the vertices. And it looks like that. You see, you can have a bunch of space-like links to the right and the left, and a bunch of time-like links up and down, but only four groups of them kind of alternating exactly in the way I drew. And you see that the light cones at the vertex are, well, well-behaved. At least they're not more than two. Yeah. So this we impose as a local condition. And we can then show that with appropriate kind of global boundary conditions, that leads to a globally causal structure in the sense of being well-behaved and having kind of a forward time flow. But as you can see, there are now no distinguished spatial manifolds, submanifolds that consist, say, of these space-like edges. Of course, there are many ways to draw space-like edges through this triangulation somehow, but there is no distinguished one. So what happens if you now look at the model dynamically? We didn't do it in 3+1 because it's incredibly computationally intensive, but we do it in 2+1, which is very similar in terms of the macroscopic quantities one studies. In particular, one has found an emergent three-dimensional de Sitter space in it for the standard CDT. So now we are generalizing the setup. Yeah? We have a much bigger ensemble. And we just ask ourselves, how does the physics that comes out of that, depending on where we are in coupling constant space, how does it compare to what we see in standard CDT? we see we have to do the same thing. We have to fine-tune lambda as usual. We are left with a two-dimensional phase space. In that phase space, you can then find an extended region where seemingly the generalized CDT geometries just want to be foliated. So they dynamically, they revert to being kind of the almost strictly time foliated configurations of CDT. And when one then, of course, one has then to reintroduce a notion of time. So we've done that. We've introduced some kind of, well, intrinsic notion, but kind of an average notion of time. We have then studied, again, volume profiles. And we've been able, in this region of phase space, to recover a quite beautiful matching again to the de Sitter type profiles. That seems to show, and of course, we are making an assumption in saying this, a similar thing will happen in 3 plus 1 dimensions. This provides non-trivial evidence that the time foliation is actually not strictly necessary in order to produce a nice semi-classical results we've seen in standard CDT. It is, however, extremely convenient to work with this time label, but it doesn't seem to be strictly necessary. And for many more details on this, in a week's time, Samuel Jordan is talking about this here. Okay, that brings me to the end of my talk. There are many, many more things I could talk about, but I should also come back sometime and I should release you. So this is kind of a summary, you know, in a nutshell, as Z would say. CDT is a past integral formulation of gravity. It incorporates the dynamical nature of geometry. It incorporates at a quite fundamental level also causal structure of geometry. As I've outlined, it depends on rather little background structure, not of the, you know, aesthetic type, as little as one could get away with, but quite little. And it also entails that one, there are relatively few free parameters one can play around with when things kind of don't work out as they should. But so far, we are in the lucky situation that we are seeing interesting things. The toolbox that is associated with this provides a kind of experimental lab that enables us to, you know, to measure observables and to come out with numbers. And this is important also in comparing to other approaches that do this, but slightly differently. As we've seen, we can make now, therefore, quantitative statements about geometry, especially in the Planckian regime. And of course, the quantum geometry is kind of they should be thought of as the properties of the ground state of quantum gravity, which we've constructed dynamically. We've obtained from first quantum principles, we've illustrated beautifully the emergence of geometry. And yeah, what is maybe a little bit puzzling to me is that, you know, so many models that people play around with haven't actually reproduced a similar result. What we've seen is, or what I've tried to tell you, is that a very important ingredient of reproducing this result is truly non-perturbative. So it's entropy versus energy competing in order to produce this, and depending, of course, on the fine-tuning of the coupling constants. Now, the dynamics of space time on Planckian scales is very non-classical, so one is easily misled if one comes with a too classical intuition, and an example of that was the dynamical behavior of dimension. Now, the hunt for more observables, and it always gets back to this issue of observables, is on, but can be asked in a very, very concrete way in the specific framework. And there's a great scope for producing quantitative results and compare these with other approaches. And I would say at this stage, kind of the functional RG community looking at the asymptotic safety scenario, and of course, Astrid being one exponent of these, is kind of the closest related in terms of language. And we are really actively working to do the comparisons. And I'm also very encouraged. Since I came here a few weeks ago, a whole bunch of interesting papers has appeared that relates to this theme in one way or other. So there's the diffusion, another study of the diffusion process, potentially comparable with what we do by Kalkani, Eichhorn, Sauer, Essig. The Steve Carlips group, Josh Cooperman, and Jonathan Miller have come out with a very nice paper, including boundaries in 2 plus 1 CDT. And Timothy Budd and myself, just a few days after that, we've done a similar analysis for toroidal universes. And that's the first time kind of people have studied a non-trivial spatial topologies in this kind of setup. So lots of things are happening. And of course, we hope it will converge to the one and only quantum gravity theory somewhere in the near future, hopefully just, you know, just before I retire. And where you may learn more in the meantime is from a quite new last year's physics report we've written on the subject, in, which is, doesn't have all the recent results, but is otherwise rather detailed in terms of describing all the ingredients. And more stuff keeps appearing on my own webpage. And I thank you so much for your attention for all this time. Thank you.
I understand that here you can compute correlations at its proper distance, numerically.
So my question, what
correlations of some observable, is that possible?
Yeah, as a volumes, for instance.
Okay.
Yeah.
So my question is, can you compare correlations at time-like separation with ones at space-like separations? Are there any correlations at space-like separation?
Of what with what? I mean, we are not really, of course, you have to specify, you know, the correlations we've looked at are correlations for quite global observables. Mm-hmm. So, and the volume mode, you know, is kind of the scalar mode, the global scaling mode of the metric. That is a mode we have good access to. Mm-hmm. Anything that is more fine-grained, of course, which you would like to see, we currently don't, we are working on in 2 plus 1 to get access to. So in order to answer questions, I presume you're thinking of kind of point-point correlators, two-point correlators, for example, I first would have to identify a suitable local observable whose correlations I want to study. Yeah, and if that is to be a geometric observable, you might think it's a curvature, but we do not have currently notions of curvature that remain meaningful in the large n limit. So all naive notions of curvature we have here that you might then expect to appear, say, in curvature-curvature correlators, they blow up. So the more local the question, I mean, eventually, certainly, I will hope to be able to answer such a question, and I will hope to be able to, you know, answer, is, say, also matter I put on this thing, does it correlate in a way I expect. Yeah. And of course, in lower dimensional models, these plays have been played endlessly. And say, you can look at the spin-spin correlator. That's what people have, for instance, studied in two dimensions. And you find you reproduce beautiful expected types of correlators. You cannot do them analytically, but you can see them just numerically. So in principle, yes. I'm very far from being able to say anything about the specific objects you're asking right now in this context. So I'm, you know, I'm very, all my observables are very, very non-local.
I see.
But I mean, it is almost impossible for us to say something about the difference between space-like and time-like, because we have rotated to a hidden space. Mm-hmm. And not to say that, in principle, you should then calculate the results in the hidden space and then rotate them. But we know that you cannot really rotate numerical results back. I mean, so in this sense, the only thing you can address, probably in such computer simulations, are observables which are not sensitive to this kind of rotation, or in a rather trivial way. But it's almost impossible to take a correlator and rotate. Well, because an exponential falling off function can be an oscillating function and rotate back. And you cannot see this from the numerical data. I mean, well, so in this sense, it's very difficult to answer this kind of question. I mean, apart from all the other problems that Renata mentioned, the local things, even if we had access to local things, like point-point correlators or whatever you like, matter fields and so on, it would be very difficult for us to say, probably to rotate them back.
So should I understand it as it's difficult to identify space-like separations from the numerical simulation?
Well, I mean, once you have rotated to Euclidean space, I mean, there is, of course, no real difference between space and time-like things. So when you calculate kind of correlators, well, So if you have a correlator which falls off with a mass, say, exponential mass, then you can use it to identify the mass. And this mass will be the same after you rotate back. But you cannot separate, you cannot say anything about the time lag, especially like components of this new fit. Because that requires that you could really find the real analytic constellation in terms of the function. And it's just close to impossible.
Yeah, are there any more very urgent questions?
John had a question. John had a question.
There's a researcher at the University of California at Irvine who's done computer studies for Gravity 2. I forget his name at the moment.
Herbert Humber.
Yeah. Can you compare what you learned with what he learned?
I mean, as far as I know from the publication from these groups, they haven't actually done any numerical studies for on the order of, I don't know, 15 years even. So everything after that has been, well, theoretical consideration of quantum ratchet calculus, which is in principle kind of a complementary and alternative setup to this one. One has never seen in these numerical simulation signs of extended emergent geometry like we're doing here. It's a purely Euclidean framework. From that point of view, you might say, well, maybe that's not so surprising that they didn't, but I don't know to what extent they have maybe re-examined this question after we've come up with this, you know, CDT framework, which is of course not as old. There have been speculations on how one has to tune. That's the last thing I remember from the published data to do with the simulations, on how one has to analytically continue in the coupling constant plane of the simulation in order to maybe see some interesting structures. Various things were measured, correlators in particular, making some shortcuts in the derivation. I don't know how people, that excludes myself, because I didn't work with these structures, didn't find this very significant. That's the impression I had. So there were some claims about phase transitions also, and dependence on Newton's constants, and how one might map these onto, you know, analytic expectations. So that's all I can say about this. It would be good if you're closer to him to ask him specifically.
There was one final question.
Yeah, a couple of times you mentioned that you were trying to avoid topology change.
Yes.
But then there are other lines of thought that lead to the conclusion that it really is inevitable in quantum gravity. I'm just wondering, do you have a reason, a principle why it shouldn't be there, or is it more a practical issue that it's difficult to include it here? Or what was the basis of those comments?
Well, the basis is kind of, you could say maybe naive implementation of what we call, you know, well-defined causal structure. You know that if you allow space-time topology changes, then of course none of these partition functions is well-defined. They're just too divergent as a function of the volume. Of course, including your own, you know the type of problems you run into. I'm not saying they are insoluble, but so we want to stay with partition functions that are exponentially bounded, which we can kind of renormalize with standard arguments. So you might think, of course, of some gradation of how you choose your ensemble by allowing, you know, ever more general types of objects into the ensemble. And in 1+1 dimension, we've of course also played around exactly with reintroducing, you know, the possibility of topology change. And as long as you do it kind of, you know, step by step, and you don't allow things if you don't require, if you don't take the sum over genus as part of your full path integral, then you can still, you can say things analytically. So you have some topology change of space as a function of time, but you're working only with one, say, cylindrical overall fixed space time topology.
I didn't understand that.
Okay, so maybe in view of time, close the general discussion. And
thank you.
Thanks to those of you who have cake and cookies for discussion after the talk. And let's thank Renata.
Thank you.